So even though the parasha begins, Ki teitze lemelchama, when you're going to go out to war, it's not the first time in recent memory that the Torah uses that exact formulation. What I mean by that is, in last week's parasha, Parashat Shoftim, we also had a section, Ki teitze lemelchama, when you're going to go out to war. Which means, in a sense, this beginning is not a clear beginning. If I want to go back and look at what we can call the more national concerns of the people, so you have things like war. You have issues of national concern, but as I said, this is not the first one, it's not the only one. You also have, for example, appointing a king. Appointing a king is also of a national concern, which is found in Shoftim. And the truth is that most of the national concerns are in Shoftim, and we seem to, at some point in this week's parasha in Ki Teitze, make a shift to a lot of more social, private concerns, marriage, family, and so on, compared to the more national concerns. So, let's take a look at, for us, what is source number one. And I'll say some things which are very well known. Ki teitze lemelchama al oivecha. The first section that we have, which is in Pasuk Yud, Perek Kaf Aleph Pasuk Yud, when you go out to war against your enemy, and then God allows you to be successful, and he allows your enemies to be captured in your hands, vishavita shivya, and you have collected captives from this battle. Torah continues, V'ra'ita b'shivya, and you see among the captives, Eshet Yifat Toar, you see a beautiful woman, V'chashakta ba, and you had desire for her, V'lakachta l'chayisha, and you take for her as a wife. Now, the truth is that this is somewhat bizarre. I mean, I could well imagine your husband's coming home from Milawim, and how was it? Well, good news or bad news? No, it really, really is quite bizarre. Rashi identifies one of the difficulties within this, and Rashi says in source number two, "V'lakachta lecha le'isha, you will take her as a wife." Lo dibra Torah ela keneged yetzahara. The Torah over here is making what we can call a concession to the evil inclination, a concession to the Yetzer Hara, which of course then sets us up on a whole other series of questions. Why should the Torah be making a concession in this particular place? Why not make a concession, and the Torah should say, and you were walking down the street, and you saw, you know, this beautiful non-kosher restaurant, and you desired it. So go in and take a bite. Meaning, why in the world make a concession over here to the Yetzer Hara? I mean, I'm just saying, fundamentally, it seems antinomian, it seems counter to the very, you know, texture of what the Torah is about. It's about controlling one's nature, about controlling one's instincts. I mean, if man, and I mean man as man and woman, if man were unable to control their instincts, then all religion would be an absurdity. And basically, what the Torah is a set of instructions to tell us how we need to control our instincts in all kinds of areas when it comes to, you know, how we eat, how we sleep, how we conduct business, and so on and so forth, that one has to, you know, control themselves. Which, therefore, the question then becomes really, you know, a very daunting philosophical question. Why in this particular case is there a concession taking place? And I suggested at one point, this was not a, this wasn't planned, but in my first book, which somebody had actually asked me to bring in today, but in my first book, Explorations, I do go into at length to try to deal with that question. One of the things that I suggested was that the words "keneged yetzer hara" does not mean concession, but rather means a strategy against the Yetzer Hara. What does the word keneged mean? It means against. So it could be a strategy against the Yetzer Hara, and it's a way to deal with the Yetzer Hara. Basically, what is it? You see this woman, and you desire her. Now, let's be honest for a second. War is a place where values get confused. War is a place where you do all the things that they told you not to do in kindergarten. Right? Don't steal, don't take what isn't yours, don't kill, right, and so on and so forth, which means it's a real place for a break, a complete breakdown of morality. So within this context of a breakdown of morality, it does transpire in various armies. There was just one in the news recently, in various armies, where outrages take place in a sexual realm. So over here, the Torah may actually being doing something which is a strategy, which is an incredible strategy, and that is, it says, okay, you want to take this woman, wonderful, but she'll become your wife. Which means, and as she becomes your wife, she then gets all kinds of privileges as being a wife. Which means she gets the credit card, right? She gets the car. She gets all kinds of privileges, and that may stand as this keneged yetzahara, which means, oh, you want to take this woman, fine, there are implications, which means Judaism doesn't really believe in sexual relations outside of marriage. You want to have sexual relations, that's a wonderful thing, but then take this woman as a wife, which, by the way, then will stand as a theme which will be repeated at other times within this week's parsha, which I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit. Give me a cup of water, please. The next two sections over here, in source number one, which are bolded in your first sources, in Pasuk Ted Vav, it says, if a man has two wives, one he likes and one he doesn't like. And then in Pasuk Yud Chet, and there it says, don't displace the elder son, right, of the woman who you do not like, in favor of the son of the younger son who of the woman that you do like, or you do love. In Pasuk Yud Chet, it then speaks about Ki Yehi Ish Ben Sora Umora, when a parents will have a child who is a rebellious child. So we have three sections, one after the other over here. Yifat Toar, Ahuva V'snua, Ben Sora Umora. Rashi, back in source number two, after he says, this is Keneged Yetzahara, he says, Shem Ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu Matira, Yesi Eino Be'isur. Because if God didn't allow this, it would take place anyway. Which, again, that goes back to this, either, as I said, your choice, concession or strategy. Aval Im Nas'a, but if he does marry her, what should he then realize? Sofo Liot Sona'a. In the end, he's going to hate her. Now, this is interesting. Because when I just now mentioned there are two wives, the one that he loves and the one that he hates, how would we know to identify which one is which? So why would you suspect that this young, beautiful cheerleader, which, by the way, is really what they were in terms of battle. Thank you very much. That's really what they were. They were cheerleaders who would come out literally to the battlefield. Battles were conducted differently in those days than they are today, which is basically battle means hand-to-hand battle. And they did have distractions on the side, which means that these women who were out there by the battlefield, more likely than not, were there as part of the military strategy as a distraction. Okay? I'm quoting different commentaries now, but we don't need to see them all inside. So why would this woman, who he's attracted to, why would he eventually hate her? This, by the way, is a very simple question, and you're allowed to answer the question.
Because she's
going to
look ugly.
Because why? Because she's going to look ugly afterwards. That's a good question. Why the?
She's going to cause problems in the household. He takes her home, and the first wife's going to be unhappy, and it's going to be a whole...
And something more basic, which I think some of you maybe have forgotten. They don't have all that much in common. Right? You know, the whole courtship over here of the two was not under the best circumstances. And you're not dealing with a type of a relationship which is, let's put it this way, has long-term success, which will, you know, follow it. Because you're dealing with something which is actually looking for one word, and it's basically lust. That's all that there is that he sees an attractive woman. He again, think of it in terms of politics, military, strength. You know, he can use his strength against her. This is not a relationship. This is not what was described at in the beginning in the Garden of Eden, when it says, and the two of them shall be one of one flesh, and so on and so forth. This is not a situation where Yitzchak takes Rivka into his tent and it says that he loved her. This is not... Actually, I don't think I saw the word love at all over here. By the way, I did use the word love in one context. Where was the word love? Now that we look at Rashi, where was the word love? Regarding the other wife. Regarding the other wife who was sitting at home. That's the only place that there's love over here. Rashi's telling us this wife who's going to be despised is basically a symbol of his own weakness. That's what she is. I mean, what do they have in common? She's an idolater who he dragged by the hair and took her home, and she's his conquest. I mean, again, do you think that the odds are that this is going to work as a relationship? If it is, we can open up a whole new shidduch business. Right? This isn't something which is going to work. Again, you all appreciate what I'm saying over here. This is, again, I think this is fundamental, and that's what Rashi's saying. Worst comes to worst, I won't answer.
So what do you do with the whole Gemara in Kedushin that talks about the snuah is something different altogether, having nothing to do with your
Batama? I don't do anything right now because I'm not learning the Gemara in Kedushin. If I were, then again, what's interesting is the way that Rashi, and again, Rashi is not, Rashi as 95% at least, is using sources over here. So Rashi over here is seeing a chain of events which are taking place. The Gemara in Kedushin takes this in its more literal, right, understanding, which is independent of the source before, independent of the source afterwards, and speaks about a more classic situation of somebody having more than one wife. Okay, so it's essentially the difference between trying to understand law as law, which is what the Gemara in Kedushin does, versus trying to understand the law as it comes within the context of a biblical narrative. And even if it's narrative, is not a simple word to use over here because it may be narrative or it may be something else, but it's within the context of the Bible. And it's interesting, but especially when it comes to Sefer Devarim, the Gemara tells us that we should be more attuned to sequence of laws which are being taught. Because in Sefer Devarim, it's essentially a man-made, and I don't want to get into this whole discussion now, but it's essentially a man-made document in as much as you're dealing with a speech that Moshe Rabbeinu gave. So being a speech, it's constructed with a certain human logic, even though eventually it gets its authority as a divine document by God saying to Moshe to write down the speech that you gave. But therefore, the Gemara does see the narrative of Devarim as being something which is important, and Rashi's basically following this approach. Now look. None of you have any idea where I'm going with this yet. Let's just finish the last point of Rashi now. Rashi then tells us, and guess what happens afterwards? When you have somebody who goes out to war, drags the wife home by the hair, has her cut her hair and all these other things afterwards, which most likely is seen as a sign of mourning. Either she's mourning her parents or she's mourning her idolatry, is the way that some of them put it, and now she's going to have a new life. And you talk about the whole discussions of conversions that take place today. Here you have a forced conversion. I mean, exactly how does she accept Torah and mitzvot over here? You have a forced conversion which is taking place here. And then we're told that Rashi says, oh, and guess what? You're going to eventually hate her. And then one more ramification. It says, and what's going to happen afterwards? It says, v'sofa lo lid mimena ben sor amore. And afterwards, she will end up giving birth for him a child who's a rebellious child. Now, why this child will turn out to be rebellious probably is not the biggest surprise, or the biggest, right? Here you have the child who's the product of basically a dysfunctional family where the husband and the wife come from very, very different backgrounds, where the husband and wife probably don't have all that much in common, where the husband and wife may not necessarily have all that much love for one another over here. Basically, she's his conquest. That's what it is. And more than that, you have a husband or a father, as the case may be, with what we can call very poor impulse control. So, right? So then...
Except what does one
think? Excuse me?
Except...
Okay, good. Accept it. But what Rashi's basically telling us over here, yes, the Torah made a concession, or, as I said, a strategy, but it's not a very good idea to take it up on it, because basically here is a prescription to ruin your life. Okay, that's what Rashi leaves us with. Now, the Gemara tells us, and this is source number 3. You have the English, but follow me in the Hebrew. The Tanya, ben sor mor lo hoya velo atid liot. The Gemara tells us there never was a child who's a ben sor mor. Never happened, never will happen. By the way, that's very interesting. So it never happened and never will happen. V'lama nichtav, why was written? Derosh v'kabel schar, in order to be able to learn about it and receive reward for the learning. Kiman, whose opinion does this follow? K'Rabbi Yehuda. It follows the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda. Ibat Eimer, Rabbi Shimon, or you can say it's the opinion of Rabbi Shimon. The Tanya, as we learned, Rabbi Shimon taught on a Braita. Amar Rabbi Shimon, v'chim ebnei she'achal zer tar temar basar. He ate a certain amount of meat. V'shatachat silog yain ha'italki, and he drank a certain amount of wine. Aviv v'imo motzino to l'saklo. His mother and father will take him out to be killed. Now, it's interesting. According to the opinion of Rabbi Shimon, why did this never happen? Is it because there never was a rebellious child? No. What's the reason? That you never had parents that will treat the rebellious child in the way that the Torah is telling us that perhaps he should be treated. Which means what happens in the Chumash? It says in Pasuk Yud-Chet, Ki eli ish ben sor mor, einu shomea b'kol aviv v'kol imo, v'yisru oto, v'lo yishma leim, v'tafsu bo aviv v'imo, v'tzil zikne yiro, which means the parents have to take him to court, put charges against him, again, bring up witnesses and so on and so forth, and eventually have the child executed. How many parents do you know? Listen, you may want to do this to your child. You may have a fantasy about doing this to your children. But what is Rabbi Shimon's position here? It says, this never happens, never will happen. Why? Because no parents are going to do this. So it's interesting. What did this leave us with? It's not that there's never been a child who's been a candidate for this. When it says, lo hayu v'lo nivra, it doesn't mean that this is such a rare occurrence, you will never have a child like this. But what does it mean, according to the Gemara? It means that you'll never have a child who deserves it, whose parents will go and actually implement it. Ella lo hayu v'lo atid liot. Therefore, Rabbi Shimon also concurs and says, never happened and never will. V'lama nichtav drosh v'kabel schar. So that we can get rewarded for it. Why teach it? So rabbis can get paid for it. That's not really what it means. Okay, drosh v'kabel schar. Rav Yonatan. Rav Yonatan apparently does not agree with the previous opinion. What does he say? Ani ra'iti v'yashavti al kivro. No, I saw ben sor mor and I sat on his grave. Which is a very, very stark way of describing that really was such a case. So, let me ask you a different question. Rashi told us that there is this whole chain of events that takes place. Was there ever an Eishet Yiv HaTorah? Let's start with an easier question. Was there ever an incidence of Eishet Yiv HaTorah? Before we get to the question, was there ever... Was ever in Jewish history, was there ever a case of Eishet Yiv HaTorah? Because if there was a case of Eishet Yiv HaTorah, then maybe we'd be better equipped to try to figure out if there was ever a case of Ben Sor Mor and what happened with that case. So what's the answer? So by the way, this was my starting point, just in case you want to know how my mind actually approached the topic. When I read Ben Sor Eishet Yiv HaTorah, the first question was, in my mind, who would be the paradigm of such a relationship? Is there such a case in Tanakh? Is there such an example of it? Cosby and Zimri, it's very hard to say Eishet Yiv HaTorah, because she seems to be a very enthusiastic, willing participant. David HaMelech would be our candidate, which is why we're going to spend the rest of today on David HaMelech. And before I get to David, I do want to say one thing. There's been a whole debate which has taken place for the better part of the last 20 years or so, which is, anybody else needs sources? There's plenty of more over here. The debate which has existed in Hebrew has been called, do you study Tanakh migova enayim or not? So what does migova enayim mean? Gova enayim literally means eye level, which means do you look at David eye to eye? Which means do you look at him as being essentially a contemporary, or I'll use a different language, do you see him as a human being? Or do you see our biblical heroes as essentially people that we can't see eye to eye, that we can't even look at their ankles? These are spiritual giants who are way beyond. What's the difference in the approaches? which means if I say that somebody's a spiritual giant, so essentially I have no right to judge them because these people are just so great and so on and so forth that I can't judge them, and there must be some explanation for everything that they do, even though it may at times seem problematic. If I look at them, Migol Veinayim, so then I can say, okay, you know, what's going on over here? Now, I will do both a little bit today. I will do both. I will bring some Gemarot, and I will look at the text. On the other hand, the starting point has to be to understand the pshat. When I say pshat, I don't want to call it the simple level, the direct level. We need to understand the pshat in the Navi. We're going to look at some passages in the Navi, and then if you want to whitewash afterwards, that is your right. But I'll just leave it another thing. We may end up today with more questions than we have answers to. Let's look at the next source in the Gemara first. So Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Kaf Aleph, it's source number 4. Amar Rabbi Yehuda Marav, Rabbi Yehuda said to Marav, which by the way is the same, is it the same tradition? No. Amar Rabbi Yehuda Marav, Rabbi Yehuda said to Marav, Arba Me'ot Yiladim Hayulu LaDavid. David had 400 children. Now, by the way, those of you who are not familiar with such biographical information, for a very simple reason, it's not listed any place in Tanakh that he had any place near that amount of children.
How do they know it?
Well, we'll see exactly what it's going to say. In fact, some of the commentaries have debated this point, whether David really had that many. There's even one commentary on the Gemara Sanhedrin, Margoliyah Tayam, who even claims that there's a misprint over here. And that there's a misprint, and then that should be 4, but we'll see. He had more than 4, but it originally had said something else, and he shows what he guesses is how this became corrupt. I don't agree with him simply because of the continuation of the Gemara. It says they had 400 children. Kulan b'nei Yifat Taor Hayu. All of David's children were b'nei Yifat Taor. What does that mean literally? That they were children of captive women. Okay. So over here we're told that David had 400 of these children, which means David kept quite busy. Umigadlei bolaritayu, that they grew their hair long. Vikulan yoshvin bekronot shel zahav, and they sat in these golden chariots. Umahalchi berushe gaisotayu, and they stood in the front of the soldiers. Vehein ba'alei egrofin shel beit David. And these were the tough guys, as it were, in David's army or David's personal.
Why did they ever have strength to fight?
We'll see about that in a minute. These were David's bouncers, as it were. Who were they? They were his children with these non-Jewish women. These are the people that he surrounded himself with, who were part of the royal court. But we can imagine that they came from somewhat of a different gene pool, and these are the tough guys who David is surrounded with. The Gemara then continues and says, "Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav, Tamar bat Yifat Tor Haita." Now, do you remember Tamar? Okay, we're going to come back to Tamar soon. That Tamar, who was she? She's David's daughter. She is the sister of Avshalom. She's the sister of Avshalom. So over here, the Gemara says, Tamar bat Yifat Tawar haita. She was the daughter of Yifat Tawar. Now, why they say this, we'll see in a second. Shenemar, for she says, Daberna el hamelech, speak to the king, ki lo yimna'ini mimecha. He will not withhold me from you. Now, the context over here we will see in 1 second. The Isak Adaitach, and if you're going to say Bat Misuimhi, that she was his daughter by virtue of a proper marriage, Achte Mihavasharile. Who could possibly allow a brother and a sister to get married? Eloshma Mina, we conclude from this, Bat Yifat Tor Haita. She was the daughter of Fatar. Now, there's another piece of information that we need. There is a debate that takes place between the Rishonim, between the various early commentaries on the Gemara, on the Torah. When this man goes out to war and sees the cheerleader and decides to take this cheerleader, now, he has this passion, so what does the Torah say? He can take this woman. And then we're told this whole process that takes place, that she cuts her hair and she mourns and this and she comes, he takes her to the house, and so on and so forth. All this that takes place, when does he have relations with her? Does he have relations with her out there by the battlefield, or do they only have relations after the entire process? So the correct answer over here is the correct answer by almost every question that I ask, and what is it? Machloket. Right? It's a difference of opinion. Except at the end of the Seder, then there's no machloket. When you get to Echad Miyodea, right? Then there's no machloket. Everything else is machloket. What's the argument? Rashi says that there is only intimacy after the entire process. Many other Rishonim take him to task and say that no, that just doesn't make sense in such a case, but rather there's intimacy on the battlefield and then goes through the entire process and then she becomes his wife. This Gemara clearly will pose a difficulty to Rashi's perspective and is used by the various commentaries to attack Rashi. Why? Because what did it just now say? That Tamar is a bat yifat toar. If Tamar is a bat yifat toar, so what did it just now imply? That she is not the child after marriage. She is a child before the marriage, because she's the bat yifat toar. So as I said, this is clear support of that perspective. Even though this is an agadah, it's not explaining law over here, but there is a legal point. Now, what was the defense? Or how is this being utilized? Let me state that clearer. Because it says that she says to her brother, you know, just ask the king. He would give me to you as wife. Now, let's go into context. And before I go any further, I want to tell you what I'm doing today so that I don't confuse you all, or at least more than necessary. I have a feeling that the whole story of David HaMelech, as it's told in Sefer Shmuel, is being told with an eye on this week's Parsha and last week's Parsha. That the whole issue over here of Yifat Toar, of Ben Sor Mora, and a couple of other cases we haven't seen yet, will ultimately shed a lot of light in Sefer Shmuel. But once we see how it sheds light in Sefer Shmuel, it will come back and give us, a lot more insight into what we're reading back in this week's Parsha. Stating it in a way that I think is very clear, I think Sefer Dvarim, Parshiot, Shoftim, and Kitzeitze are the subtext of the David HaMelech intrigue in terms of the things taking place within his palace, which shouldn't be such a surprise to us. We start with the Parshat HaMelech. Parshat HaMelech, who was the prototypical king, it's going to be David. We're going now to issues of Eshifat Torah, Ben Sor Mora, and so on. See, if I would have asked you the other question before, the question I didn't ask you, what was that one? Who's the prototypical Ben Sor Mora? Right? That should have been then a very easy answer. Avshalom is the typical, so now you can now ask yourself another question. Is Avshalom the son of the Eshifat Torah? Again, that would just make things really neat in terms of what we've already seen from Rashi before. In terms of what we've really seen from Rashi before.
No, I'm not in Tamar. I could have seen the four relations twice. I'm like, were they twins?
Slow down. First of all, let's state the easier answer. Is Avshalom the son of a Yifat Toar? Answer that question with a yes or no. Exactly. If the Gemara just told us that Tamar is the daughter of the Yifat Toar, and if we know, based on Tanakh, that Avshalom is her full brother, that means that having both the same mother and father, that means that Avshalom's mother is also a Yifat Toar.
No, I
know what you're saying. She is a Yifat Toar. The question is, at which point is Avshalom the result? Which
the
means, I'm saying his mother is Eshet Yifat Toar. Now, the question is at which juncture? I know. The question is at which juncture does she give birth to Avshalom? Does she give birth to, meaning, or what point does Avshalom, does she become pregnant with Avshalom? If you want, we could look at some of the commentaries on this, because there is a great debate on this point. Did you all follow me as far as what I'm looking for and what I was thinking about? Yes? Good.
Okay.
Only one question, then you're good.
So you're talking about is the same mother, but David is still the same father, so there's still a brother and sister. And even if they're half brother and sister, they still can't marry, right?
Okay, look at the Radak in source number 7. Achot Yafa Ushma Tamar, which now we're reading the Radak on a verse we haven't read yet, because you're not letting me read the verse yet. Tamar bat Yefator haita. Tamar was the daughter of Yefator, Kamosh Amar Rabotein Uzal, as we saw in the Gemara, Vaharaya kilo yomeni mimcha, because she says that God would not hold you back. Haita achot Avshalom mi'imo. She is the sister of Avshalom from the mother, Kima Acha, that's the name of the mother, imo shel Avshalom, l'cha David b'milchama. David took her in battle, v'shachav ima, kodem shenit gaira. He had relations with her before she converted. Ki haTorah hitira zeh keneged yetzahara, for the Torah allows this against the yetzahara, kemo shekatuv ita b'shevya eshet yifator. Which means over here we have the Radak saying in very, very clear terms, connecting David's intrigue or palace intrigue, meaning the relationship between him and his wife or wives or children, specifically over here, Tamar and Avshalom, their mother, we're told over here very clearly, was an Eshet Yifator, was a woman who David sees in battle, and it says here also very clearly that he has relations with her in the battlefield. Who is this against? This is against Rashi, right? But don't worry, it's like the Rambam and the Ramban and Tosfot, and as I said, a host of others. Almost everybody disagrees with Rashi over here. And he goes in there, okay, one second. We're skipping a little bit where it's underlined. Uma'acha nit'abra mi David b'biyah rishona ba'odo nachrit. And she became pregnant when she was still not Jewish. Lefich haita muteret Tamar la'amnon. Therefore, it's okay, it's strange. It's okay. Therefore, Tamar was allowed to marry Amnon. Because afal pi shehayta bat David, kevan shegiyuta nitabra ma'acha, she was not Jewish when she got pregnant, mena v'nitgaira ma'acha archakein, and then she converted, v'nasa David li'sha v'yada lo avshalom. So the sequence of events, according to the Radak, is David sees ma'acha on the battlefield. David acts, what word do you want to use now? Impetuously. And he takes Ma'acha, he impregnates her, she has a child who is not Jewish, called Tamar. She then converts and has another child, and his name is Avshalom. Let's start reading source number 6 now, if you have to. Yeah.
But according to the rule, it's not okay. Because according to the rule, he has to wait.
As I said, most Rishonim.
No.
Most Rishonim follow the approach that relations on the battlefield are allowed.
Okay.
So I'm saying Rashi's the exception. See, Rashi's the exception, but Rashi very often becomes in our minds the most famous one and becomes the default knowledge base for us, but Rashi happens to be a minority opinion over here. Let's read the psukim themselves. So it's very interesting. It says, and afterwards, Avshalom, the son of David, had a sister. What should have it said? That David had a daughter. This may be perhaps the sister of Avshalom, but no, it's described as the sister of Avshalom. Avshalom ben David, achot yafa ushmo Tamar. Now, the fact that she's called beautiful is also this theory of conservation of ideas, and therefore she's yafa, yeshet yafa toar, which again, just in terms of the theme, makes it a little easier. V'yahaveha, Amnon ben David, and Amnon ben David loves her. Do you like the word love being used in this context? Right. This is not a real love. It's like he says that he made love, or this is not love. It's like when people say they sleep together, they really don't sleep, and so on and so forth. Well, you know what? I'll state it differently. He may think that he loves her, right? But we'll see as it continues. V'tegesha love lechol v'chazek, and I don't want to go into the details. In Pasuk Yud Bet, he tries to force, Yud Aleph. Bechazekba, he grabs her, Vayomer Laboi Shechvi Imi Achoti. And he calls her my sister. Again, those of you who are still keeping score, they are half brother and half sister, presumably the same father, different mother. But what the Radak just told us, which is really what the Gemara told us, is that she technically doesn't have the same father. Now, I know that this is going to be a sticking point with some of you, but she technically doesn't have the same father. And why is that? Because her father is her father before, David is her father before she converted. And therefore, the Jewish father with a non-Jewish mother is of no significance halachically. Okay? V'tomer lo, and she says, Al achi, al ta'aneni, do not abuse me, ki lo yaseh kein b'Yisrael, such things are not done in Israel, which, by the way, would be a wonderful, you know, point of irony. You know, you're a Jew and she's a convert, and such things are not done in Israel. I mean, the word Israel is stronger. Al taseh ta nevela hazot. By the way, the word nevela or nevela is used in this week's parsha as well. That's your homework. You can go and see, but it is used in the context of illicit sexual relations, which is, again, when I say that our parsha is the subtext, here is a linguistic connection. V'ani ana olech, and he says, how will I deal, you know, with my embarrassment if you do this? V'atideh achad ha-nevalim v'Yisrael, and you'll be like one of the despised people. V'atah deberna la-melech, but rather, go to the king, ki lo yomneini mimecha, because he's not going to withhold me from you. Now, we all know exactly what she's doing. Right. As I said, we all know exactly what she's doing. We read this pasuk and we hear something very clear what she's saying. Here's a guy who's going to take her by force, and what is she doing? She's making an excuse. She goes, no, you don't have to do it like this. You ask the king for the hand. We'll get married. We'll have a wedding. We'll have a beautiful life together. And basically, he goes to the king and says, I'd like to marry her. And the king, you know, will put him in prison or kill her or whatever, which means that's the way I would have read it. But what is the Gemara? How did the Gemara read it? The Gemara read it as a sincere response. Oh, no, we really can get married. Why? Because I'm a convert, and my father is not my father halachically, and therefore my father and your father are not the same. We don't have the same mother. We don't have the same father, so we can get married. So the Gemara read this as a sincere response. That's what's interesting over here, and that's what we had just seen in the Radak as well. He takes her by force. That's the end of Pasuk Yudalad, where it's bolded, v'yechazek mimena v'yaneh v'yishkav ota. And then right afterwards, Vayisaneha Amnon Sin Agdola Ma'od, he then hates her, Kigdoloha Sinashes Sneyamiava Asher Avea. And the hatred that he has for her is greater than love. Now, the case of rape is also mentioned in this week's parsha. The case of a person marrying a woman and hating her afterwards is mentioned in this week's parsha. I don't want to go into every single case, but if we look quickly, for example, look at source 19 on page 4. Kikach ish isha uvala usnea. A man takes a woman, has relations with her, and hates her. Which means, I will right now admit, when you look up that pasuk in context, it's talking about something else, but you read that verse and you look at the words over here, and again, you realize that, again, linguistically or thematically, you're dealing with something which is very similar. The other things which are mentioned over here are cases of divorce, right? Give her a sefer kritut. In source 21 on page 5, it talks about rape, and it compares rape to murder. It says, where it's bolded, Ki kasheyakum isha reyu ratzcho nefesh, kein hadavar hazeh. Just like if a man rises up and kills somebody, murders somebody, this is a similar thing. That's source 21. It's talking about rape. It's talking about a source of rape, and it compares rape to murder. Let's now go back. How does the story end? Back on page 2. How does the story end? I Avshalom figures out what happened, and Avshalom is going to end up taking care of Amnon. But I want you to look at Pasuk Kaf Aleph, because there's something over here which may not really ring true. When I say not ring true, or at least be disappointing. V'hamelech David shamat kol dvarim ha'ele, v'yichar lo ma'od. What's missing? And David heard about all these things. What does it mean, v'yichar lo ma'od? He was very upset. What's missing?
The action.
Exactly. Okay. So, by the way, anybody here have children and know anything about disciplining children and getting involved in their lives and speaking and doing? But what's missing over here is just so interesting. What did the Torah forget to tell us? Or the Navi forget to tell us? What David did. So therefore, what's the very difficult answer? Is, well, David doesn't do anything. David is just upset. Now, why is David upset, and who is he upset at? So let's hold all that for a second. I'm throwing those questions out, and I wanna move on. Yeah. Correct. And look, it speaks to the Gemara in terms of the parents not wanting to really go after their kids. Because listen, it's very difficult. It's very difficult to be parents sometimes. But it goes down to a different issue. And that is, Amnon, well, you know what? Let me just fill in a couple more pieces of information that we're not going to... I don't want to read all of this, but if you look at source number 8, there's a resh missing there. It should say Rakanati. The Rakanati is a mystical commentary to the Ramban. Look at the second to the last line on page 2, the end of the line. V'kvar yadata, and you already know, ma she'ira l'David ha-melech, what happened to David. It talks about Ben Sora Mora and Eshiftar, and he says, and you already know what happened with David HaMelech. Be'inyan Tamar va'amnon va'avshalom ki kulam hayu b'nei yifat toar. All three of the characters in that story, David, Amnon, and Tamar, are all the children of Yifot Toar. Which means, what we didn't know before, is that Amnon's mother was also somebody who David happened to meet in a nice battlefield. If you want, they were different. They had different mothers. If you want to see more about this, you will. I'm sorry that this is out of order, but I wasn't going to do this here. If you want to see more about this, you will look at source 15, which is in Divrei Hayamim, which is a very concise source that goes through David's various wives and children. Don't look at it now. Just make a note of that you'll see there that Amnon and Avshalom come from different mothers, but. Who's David's mother? Nitzan? There's always a story. But hold on one second. Let me make my point. If you realize now that Amnon and Tamar and Avshalom are all children of Yifot Toar, so what has to go through David's mind right now? That part of his impetuousness when he goes out to war and he takes these women and he has, what was the term I used earlier? Poor impulse control. So you see the exact same things with his children. Which means it's almost like, okay, David's mad, but who is he mad at? He may be mad at himself. Exactly. He may be mad at himself. Now, just to really strengthen this, everything we just now read is in chapter 13, Perek Yud Gimel, in Shmuel. Along the way, the sources will skip 9, 10, 11... and 12 and 13, which are various commentaries which will tell us along the way that Amnon and Tamar were maybe twins. You suggested that before. It's not Amnon, sorry. Avshalom and Tamar were perhaps twins, were perhaps both Yifot Toar, maybe one was, maybe the other, which means at which point is the conversion, at which point is the relationship. So that's all of page 3 that we're skipping. And by the way, on page 4, the Rambam, in source 18, actually incorporates this story in his halacha, which means the Rambam, and again, those of you who don't know why I'm stressing this, the Rambam is writing a book of law, and in his book of law, he talks about Tamar and says that Tamar, in fact, was the daughter of Yifat Tohar before she converted, and he states this as a fact of law, which means what you, again, Rashi saying that there could be no contact on the battlefield till after the conversion, the Rambam over here rules against him, and he brings the story of Tamar and the and that verse that she says, you know, my father would not hold me back from you, as a point of law. Okay, let's move over from chapter 13 in Shmuel to the Shmuel Bet. Let's move over now to Perek Yud Aleph. Perek Yud Aleph is really the start of this whole episode. Source number one, Vayihi l'tshuvat hashana la'etzei tamalachim. It's the time of year for people, for kings to go out to war. Source 22. It's the time of year, page 5. It's the time of year for kings to go out to war. By the way, what time of year is that?
Spring.
That's the spring. The spring is the time to go to war. Vayishlach David et Yoav et Avadav imo et Kol Yisrael vayashchitu p'nei Amon v'yetzu al Araba v'David Yoshev b'Yerushalayim. They go out to fight Amon. By the way, the interesting thing about Amon is that Amon is also the product of an inappropriate relationship. David, it's the time for kings to go out to war, which I bolded in the beginning of Pasuk Aleph. But what does it say at the very end of Pasuk Aleph? David Yoshev b'Yerushalayim. It's time to go out to war, but David sends proxies, and David himself chooses to stay home. Now, as one of you pointed out, when David goes to war, David seems to be quite successful on various fronts, including in collecting all types of Yifot Toar. If you go back to source 15 for a moment, it says Ve'elo yubnei David shenolad lo bechevron habechor Amon la'achinom ha'Yisraelit. Ha'Yisraelit is not of Jewish stock. Sheni Daniel Avigail ha'Karmelit. Hashlishi Avshalom ben Ma'achah ben Talmi Melech Geshur. Meaning, you see the theme over here that David keeps collecting these children with these wives who he has been collecting in various battles. Which means David staying home and not going to battle, maybe we can understand. But what does he do when he goes to battle? What does he do when he goes to battle? He does very well. Okay, good. So now, David is home. Pasuk 2, we're back in source 22. Vayihila et erev. Vayakam David me'al mishkavo, v'italech agag beit hamelech, v'yar isha rochetzet me'al agag, v'isha tovat mar'eh ma'od. Now, you have to appreciate the irony over here, because we would not have understood this had I not started the way that I started today. Which means if David were going out to war, what would be the next thing he would see? A beautiful woman, and then what would the Chumash say? Okay, go ahead. But instead, what does David do? He doesn't go to war, and he sees a beautiful woman, which means you have to appreciate it. It's the time for kings to go to war, but David doesn't go to war. And what does he see? He sees a beautiful woman. So what's the next thing that's supposed to happen? What's the answer? Nothing. But you're dealing with somebody who has exhibited until this point, by the way, now I'm guilty of Gova Einayim. We have somebody who, till this point, who's been guilty of, shall we say, some strategic relationships. If you and I'm being nice when I say strategic relationships, but according to the Gemara, what is it? He's captured these women. So it means, what is David's modus operandi at this point? To go and to take her.
Does he take these women at the battlefield? They're at the battlefield, or does he go into the towns?
I don't know. When you write the movie script, you can, that's.
Can I ask a funny question? This is all presented, and we're learning this to understand David's character and personality.
We're learning this to understand this week's parsha.
That's it.
You wanna? If you have certain, if we end up having certain opinions about David, which I'll try to get back to before I finish, then. I don't think we can avoid it. So let's continue. He sees this woman, right? Are you all familiar with the story?
Yeah.
Even Leonard Cohen made a song about it, yes?
Which story are you talking about?
What's about to happen? Right? Vayishlach David vaydrosh l'isha, and David makes inquiries. Vayomar lo zot bat sheva bat Eliam eshet Uriah hachiti. Now, I don't know who Uriah hachiti is, and I would really be happy if Uriah wasn't Jewish, because that would also make things much easier over here. And Uriah being a chiti, a chitite, would really clinch that, even though I could not find anybody who clearly said that. In fact, the story becomes more complicated. Vayishlach David malachim, he sent emissaries, vayikacheha. And when it says vayikacheha, what does that mean? He takes it to a movie. He takes it to dinner. He takes... What does vayikacheha mean? Vatavo ela vayishkav ima, vihi mitkadeshet mitum ata, vitashav el beta. Now, what is her role in all of this? I actually did a bit of research and I found those non-Jewish scholars. Somebody who suggested that she basically seduced him, which I think is an absurdity. Why is she laying on, again, basically blame the victim. Why is she blaming on the roof that a peeping Tom can possibly see her and then get excited? I thought that was an absurdity. When I ask over here, what is her role in this, I think there's a one-word answer to that. What's that? Victim.
To reinforce
David's... She is a victim. A matter of fact, the Gemara understands from this, which I think is a very good conclusion, that she was raped. Is she a willing participant? You don't see that at all over here. What does it say? V'yikachel, she was taken, and he lay with her, and so on, and she goes back home. Now, there's one piece of bad news. I mean, that should have been the end of it, right? Shall we call it a momentary indiscretion? That should have been the end of it. But there sometimes momentary indiscretions actually have ramifications. And this particular case has a ramification. And what's the ramification?
She's pregnant.
And she sends a message to David and said, guess what? So what David does next is very interesting. And I want to pause for a second. The Gemara in Source 24, here is now an attempt to whitewash. Amar Reb Shmuel bar Nachmani, Amar Reb Yonatan, Kola Omer David Chata, Einu Ela Toeh. Anybody who says David sinned is mistaken. Which, by the way, there's two possibilities. One is he's mistaken because David didn't sin. The other possibility is he's mistaken for saying it. Whoever says David sinned is mistaken. Another possibility, right, one of the possibilities would be that he's mistaken. Why? Because David sinned and he later does tshuva. So you're not supposed to remind about tshuva of their sin. But as whoever says David sinned is mistaken, so which approach is correct? It says, Shenema vihi David l'kod rechav maskil v'hashem imo, that God was with him. Efsher chata, should be chet, for chata, chet balidavo u'shchina imo, could he really have sinned like this and the shchina is with him? Elamani makaye madua bazita et dvar Hashem la'asotara. When later on he is told, why did you find the word of God disgusting to you? La'asot hara. So it says, shebikesh la'asot v'lo asa. He wanted to, but he didn't do it. How is this possible? Rebbe Omer mishuna razu mikora asha b'torah, shekora ot shebotorah k'tiv bo v'yas, v'kan k'tiv la'asot. In other cases, it would have said that he did something wrong. Over here, it says that he wanted to. Shebikesh la'asot v'lo asa. How is that? It says that Uriah chiti ikita b'cherev. Shehaya l'chal adonu b'sanhedrin v'lodanta. We'll see later that the husband gets killed. You should have brought him to court and judged him. Why should he have been judged? Hold on that for a second. But ishto l'kachta l'isha, and you took his wife as your wife. L'kuchin yesh l'cha ba. Yeah, it was legal. L'kuchin yesh l'cha ba. It was a legal marriage. D'amar Shmuel bar Nachmani, Amar Yonatan. Kol hayotzei l'malchut beit David kotev get kritut l'ishto. The Gemara over here claims that whoever was in David's army before they would go to battle would give their wives a get, a conditional get, or a complete get. They would give a get. And again, exactly the language of the get is debated by various authorities. But by the way, this is not it's not a terrible idea. It's a very interesting idea. It solves various things.
It's an idea that was used during World War II, but
men went to battle, and they weren't sure they would come back, so they gave the conditional.
Right, right, right. I'm saying it's a very interesting idea. It's not a simple one. And in terms of social policy and public policy, there are various issues to debate back and forth on this. But the Gemara claims that, and again, the basic thing that it solves is the problem of a potential aguna. Aguna not in the way that the word is sometimes used today of a husband who doesn't want to give the get, but in the classical sense of a husband, of a woman who's chained because her husband has disappeared. I spent the better part of this week reading about how the various Batei Din solve the various problems or challenges in terms of 9/11. It's even in Mishpacha. I actually read the book. So the book's about each and every case, and it's fascinating how they solve it. That was real agunot, because there were certain times there was no body, and certain times there was no body, but there was DNA. And the question, you know, to what extent do you can halacha trust DNA? The answer is absolutely can. But over here, it's, as I said, a very interesting suggestion. So now, let's get the larger context over here, because you're going to see why I find this somewhat challenging. And we're going to have to start to wind down. David HaMelech takes this woman. She finds out that she's pregnant. He calls the husband back from the battlefield, and he tells her, go and be with your wife. He refuses. By the way, once he refuses, what is his status at that moment when he refuses? Right. At that point, that's what the Gemara says. That David had the right to kill him because David is the commander-in-chief. The king says to do something. And by the way, in Sefer Shmuel Aleph, when they ask for a king, what does Shmuel say? That's the Parsha HaMelech that we didn't see in last week's Parsha when we read in Shoftim. It says, king is not going to be a great idea. You're going to have to listen to the king. King is going to take your daughters. Well, that's real interesting in terms of this as well. The king is going to say, well, you have to listen to the king. The king said, go home. You have to go home. He refuses to go home. At that point, he could be put on charges. What David does, however, David says, come home and go to your wife. Now, why does David do this? Simple answer. So that he can be intimate with his wife. And then when she announces her pregnancy, so then... Correct. Exactly. That's my problem with the Gemara. What's your name?
Adina.
That's my problem with the Gemara. But hold on a second. David, by bringing Uriah back and sending him to his home, cancels the get that he sent. If the get is canceled, that means that now, retroactively, David slept with a married woman, not with a single woman. Mm-hmm. Which means this whole answer of the Gemara was wonderful. That's what Adina understood. That, as I said, we could debate it, but that's generally how it's understood, that it's not an absolute get, unless you want to say it's an absolute get. But most say no, that it's a get which is al tanai, it's a conditional get. He comes back, so then retroactively, it's not. And by the way, and if it was a real get, so then, if it's a real get, and he does come back, so then how could David then continue to be with this woman afterwards? Because then the whole thing becomes somewhat challenging. And I want to understand really what takes place over here, and most importantly, you said, well, we get to the character of David. We will. Well, what David does is he says to go home. The guy refuses. David then invites him for a drink. They get drunk together, and he says, okay, now go home, and he refuses. David then sends him out to the front with very specific instructions, and he dies. Let's get back to Pasuk. Her husband has died. And she eulogizes her husband. So again, is she sad? It sounds like she's sad. Vayavor ha'evel. The mourning period passes. Vayishlach David sends for her. Vayasfa, he collects her. El beito vatihilo the isha, and she becomes his wife. Atelid lo ben, and he has a child. Vayira hadavar ashesa David b'nei Hashem, and what David did is bad in the eyes of God. And by the way, the Gemara says whoever says David sinned is mistaken. So I don't know if the Navi is mistaken as well. At this point, the Navi didn't say he sinned, but it certainly says that God is not particularly pleased. With which point is God not pleased? Is God, and you could say all the above. Is God not pleased for taking this woman? Is God not pleased for sending out the husband to be killed? Is not God, again? But what's interesting over here is the Eisha Yifatora theme, taking this wife, this case of rape taking place, sending out to be killed, and I have to point out to you, this is chapter 11. We started with chapter 13, when the same thing takes place in David's house with his children, with the Eishet Yifator, with the children of Yifator, with the rape taking place in his house, with Avshalom going out and killing and having Amnon killed. All of this takes place afterwards, which means the theme of the Eishet Yifator and the rape, all of this is played out over the next couple of chapters, which is why I'm saying let's not look at that independently or this independently. All of this seems to have the subtext of this week's parasha right there, you know, staring at us. Which leads me to chapter 12, because chapter 12 is the important chapter for us in terms of the ultimate questions that we're going to be left with. So why exactly do we think David is a good guy? I mean, that's think, part of the challenge now of continuing, which is probably the reason why they don't learn Navi in yeshiva, because you don't want to have such questions. Look, if a rabbi today, and by the way, that already is fundamentally unfair, because David's not a rabbi as such. If a rabbi today were to act as David, then I would assume so, and deservedly so. I remember a couple of years ago, there was one particular rabbi who had acted inappropriately, and most people attacked him. One person defended him and said, look, David HaMelech did the same kinds of things. What's the big problem over here? Right. So that's correct. But that is the downside of being a king. The downside of being a king is that kings do have certain rights. But let's look what happens over here. Because I just want to frame the question that we need to ask. The question really is, how is David going to get out of all this? And now the subtext of that is, how's David's response really going to be different from whose response? From Shaul's response. Because Shaul, when he's faced, you know, with certain decisions he has to make, basically fails, which is a very interesting comment in terms of politics and leadership. It's not always it's not that you don't make mistakes. It's how you deal with the mistakes afterwards. Is it the attempted cover-up? Again, Nixon lost the presidency not because of Watergate, but because of the cover-up of Watergate. Nixon was not involved in Watergate, as far as anyone knows, even with the missing 17 minutes and so on, of 18 minutes of tape. Nixon lost the presidency because of the cover-up. It's the cover-up, which is, you know, okay, I messed up, now how do I deal with having messed up? Shaul basically said, well, I'm a king, what do you expect? I'm under certain pressure, what can I do? David over here is approached by Natan. This is in Perek Yud Bet. Natan sends for David, and he tells him this story about the two men. He talks about one man who's a wealthy individual, has lots and lots of flock. The other one is very poor, only has one particular lamb. This is source 23. And the wealthy man takes the lamb from the poor man. Now, it's very interesting. He didn't say in his parable that the wealthy man killed the poor man. Okay, I'm just pointing out what the parable is. He actually also didn't frame it in terms of illicit sexual relations. He frames it in terms of taking something from somebody else. Okay, now you could say because he gave a parable, but I still need to point that out. David's response is, and this is in the end of Pasuk Hey, Vayichar af David. By the way, here David is angry, right? We saw later on when he got angry. Here David is angry. But Ishmaod, very much at the person, Vayomer Natan, Chai Hashem ki ben mavet ha'ish ha'oseh zot. A person who takes which isn't his should be put to death. Now that's fascinating. Because you remember David's response to Amnon? What was it there? And what was missing? The action over here, that person should be killed. Now there's one thing that you know and I know that he doesn't know. And what's that? That he's talking about him. Natan informs him that he's talking about him. And I would say, when Natan turns the table on him and say, this is you, David at that point, A, complete cover-up, or B, says he's guilty. Which one is the right answer? Which one? He says he's guilty. And when he says he's guilty, what does he believe should happen to him next? No. David believes he's going to die. David, again, this is part of the character issue that we really need to understand. David believes that he will now die. How do I know that? A, he said it, and B, let's go back and take a look. First of all, the Navi says that all these kinds of things will happen in your home, and these things, you did something secretly, it will happen in broad daylight. I'm in Pasuk Yud Gimel now. Vayomer David on Natan, Chatati LaHashem, I've sinned against God. Vayomer Natan el David, Gam Hashem hivir chatatcha, lo tamut, you will not die. Which means the fact that Natan has to reassure him and tell him he will not die, tells me that he thought he would. Last verse, Ve'nachem David et Batsheva Ishto, and David comforted his wife, Ve'yavo Eleha, Ve'yishkav Ima, Ve'telid Ben, Ve'tikrat Shmo Shlomo, Vashem Ahivo, and God loved him. Now it's very interesting. Shlomo we know is the result. By the way, what number son was Shlomo from Batsheva? He was actually number 4. See that? It was worth coming today just for that. It was actually, if you look at source 15 now, in Pasuk Hey, this is in Divrei Yomim, the Eilin Adulo B'Yushalayim, Shim'a V'Shovav V'Natan U'Shlomo.
What number we have?
This is in source 15, in Divrei Yomim. It says that he calls her Batshua, not Batsheva, Batshua. He has 4 sons, Shim'a V'Shovav V'Natan U'Shlomo. First of all note the name of the third son, Natan, who presumably he names after
the Navi.
Rav Meidan has a book that I have not read called David and Batsheva, who actually suggested that all 3 of the sons die. All 3 of the sons die, not just the one, one after the other. And over here when it says, and David comforts her. Now, this is the issue. How do we understand David's relationship with Batsheva? And I have a very simple suggestion. And it comes back, and this is why we did all this today. When we open up the Chumash in this week's Parsha, and we read about a situation of rape. What are we told is the behavior that the man who rapes a woman? What? Yeah, it's her choice. If she wants to retain the status of wife, it's her choice. He's not allowed to divorce her. And he has to respect, meaning basically, you abused her, now take her full responsibility, which, by the way, philosophically is not so different from the Eshet Yifat Torah situation. I have a suspicion that David's relationship with Batsheva is based upon that pasuk in the Torah. That everything that happens after, by the way, the one thing which is missing in the whole relationship, and you can look, David ends up having a great deal of respect for her, and he treats her better than he treats anybody else, practically. And there's one word which is always missing in that relationship, and what is that? The word love is never there. The only time you saw love here is that God loves Shlomo, which means the relationship with Batsheva is basically the relationship that David has as a Baal Tshuva towards somebody who he has wronged. Which means that's the significant point over here. David HaMelech is impetuous, which now creates this fascinating question. You know, what do you do with the ADHD kid that can't sit in class? Well, who else is going to take on Goliath? No, I'm being very serious now. Other than somebody who's impetuous, what? It's hilarious. Who else is going to go on and take on Goliath, than somebody who is a certain type of a personality? Which means God is essentially saying, this is a personality that is going to be able to lead. This is a personality who's going to be able to lead by example. This is a personality who's going to be able to do all kinds of wonderful things. But there's a downside to this. We've seen today the downside of David's impetuousness. We've seen the downside of his, not necessarily, of his risk-taking. We've seen the downside of his being able to do things which, you know, just going and taking what he wants. Well, there is an upside to it. What's the upside to it? The upside to it is, well, that could be a very interesting military leader. That could be somebody who's very interesting in terms of going out to war. That's somebody. But you need something else. And what is that? And again, there's a one-word answer. You need a conscience. Which means you're going to make mistakes, but you need a conscience. David HaMelech shows he has a conscience. And how does he show he has a conscience? When he turns around and he says, that person should die. And instead of then, and he had choices, he could have killed Natan. Right? We have cases where Nevi'im were killed because we didn't like what they were saying. He could have killed him. David does the opposite. What does David do? He names his kid after him. Again, interesting. After, presumably, he loses one or two, he names his kid after Natan, which means, okay, he has love and respect for the person who has chastised him. That is just a very interesting personality trait. David over here, and again, this is really the greatness of David. It's not that he wrote Tehillim. It's what he said in the Tehillim. It's the humility that we find in the Tehillim afterwards. It's his ability to embrace the sin that he had committed, the ability to take responsibility for the sin. Because, again, how easy would it have been to David to take Bathsheba and just throw her away, you know, like a used whatever? He doesn't have to take responsibility. He's a king. He can do what he wants. Excuse me? Right. Which, and that's exactly the point. Which means after the object of lust is acted upon, easing and throw it away, which means David's anger over here is at himself, because this is really the negative of his personality manifesting itself. That's what he sees in Amnon, that's what he sees in Avshalom. And he can't say anything to them. Why? Because he knows it's all him. But David himself changes. David himself changes, and he's somebody who takes responsibility. And again, I think the responsibility is seen more than any other area than in his responsibility he takes towards Bathsheba, and that's what becomes so interesting. That's where Malchut Beit David continues, because this is David as the Baal Tshuva. But again, my ability to do this whole analysis came from one point today. And you can later on accuse me. When you walk out, you can say, he didn't talk about the Parsha. I want my money back, right? It's true. I didn't talk about the Parsha directly, but I show how the Parsha plays itself out, I think, in the realest possible sense in these chapters in Sefer Shmuel. And by seeing how they play themselves out, I think we also learn something in terms, again, great insight, in terms of the personality of David. If I'm guilty today at all of lowering David in your eyes and so on, I think you can see him as a human being, but you also see the greatness over here, because he did not have to make those choices that he made. And David basically has a very pained existence afterwards, because he sees right in front of him the results of his actions, and the results of his actions are all of these impetuous children who surrounded, who want to kill him. Avshalom wants to kill him. And David is basically rendered, you know, in a sense, defenseless, because he knows that all of this comes from him, but all that he can try to do is to fix the relationships that he can fix, take responsibility for what he can take responsibility for. And again, I think that is essentially what ends up happening with Bathsheba. So I hope this made sense. Yes?
We have a sequel to this.
You want a sequel?
Talking about all the leaders, modern leaders, President.
David could have said, I never had sex with that woman. Okay, if that's what you want.
That would be a whole semester. A whole semester
itself was very important.